What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Latin American Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Ethan Besser-Fedrick, a host of the channel, and today we'll be talking to Dr. Eleni Kafala about her new book, The Conquered, Byzantium in America on the Cusp of Modernity. Hello, and welcome to the channel, Eleni.
Hello, Ethan. Thank you for the invitation. It's great to have this conversation with you today.
I am very excited to talk to you about this book as a person who likes to study Mexico in a global context. I've never quite seen the Nahuatl people put in a global context. So I'm very excited to talk to you through this book and some of the comparisons and connections you've made between the Mexica and the Byzantines in the Eastern Mediterranean.
Mm-hmm. I look forward to that.
So to dive right in, your first chapter is called Serendipities, which I enjoy very much as a title name, and it outlines many of the parallel experiences and prophecies of the two cities you focus on in this text, Tenochtitlan and Constantinople. Now, many of the serendipities that you note here are dated after conquest, and you sort of question their mythologizing a little bit. Tell us a little bit about some of these serendipitous similarities between these two cities, Tenochtitlan and Constantinople.
Right. Well, I should first probably mention that the book was written during a fellowship at Dumbarton Oaks in Washington, D.C., where Byzantine and pre-Columbian studies come together. I mean, to my knowledge, this is the only international research institute that brings these two distinct fields of studies together. So the encounter of Byzantium and America at Dumbarton Oaks, which was a result of its founders, the Blisses, interest in Byzantine and pre-Columbian art, in itself, in a way, is a serendipity, right? So, as you've just mentioned, Ethan, the opening chapter of The Conquered is called Serendipities, right? Because it brings to the fore a number of what I call bemusing serendipities that connect Byzantium and America beyond, obviously, their fortuitous encounter at Dumbarton Oaks. One of the most striking serendipities, in my opinion, is the year 1492. As we know, that was when obviously Columbus reached what he thought to be the West Indies. The Byzantines, or Romei actually, as they called themselves, they also called their empire Eastern Roman Empire, not Byzantium. The term Byzantine Empire is a later term from the 16th century. So the Byzantines believed that the year 1492 would signal the end of the world. The term in Greek is syndelia, which literally means end of the world. And that was because in the Orthodox Christian calendar, the year 1492 corresponded to the year 7000 since creation. So the Byzantines obviously were slightly off in the timing of the fall of Constantinople, which would occur almost 40 years earlier, but they were nevertheless very accurate. I mean, they anticipated with uncanny accuracy the end of the world as they knew it. Now, Tuesday is another serendipity. Both cities fell on a Tuesday. In the case of Constantinople, that was on the 29th of May, and in the case of Tenochtitlan, on the 13th of August. Other serendipities involve ominous signs forecasting the fall of the two empires. Fire, for instance, reportedly affected the Church of Hagia Sophia, or the Church of Holy Wisdom in Constantinople, and also the house of Huitzilopochtli, the Mexica's supreme deity in Tenochtitlan. That is the Hagia Sophia and the house of Huitzilopochtli, were actually metonymies of the imperial cities themselves. Hagia Sophia was built in the 6th century, on the orders of Emperor Justinian I, and it was a symbol of Constantinople. By the same token, which reportedly was associated with the myth of the foundation of Tenochtitlan. Now, to these serendipities, we could also add the motif of the eagle and snake, which is present in the foundational mythos of both cities. The motif also appears, among other places, on the famous mosaic of the Great Palace in Constantinople, dating from the 6th century. It also appears in the Codex Duran from the 16th century. Now, the eschatological narrative of the Byzantines obviously predated the fall of Constantinople. But the omens, as you mentioned, involving the sacred places, were reported in accounts following the events, that is, after the fact, on both occasions. Like in the case of Constantinople, we have this piece of information appears in Nestor Iskander's Tale of Constantinople, a text of the late 15th, early 16th century. In the case of Tenochtitlan, this omen is reported in the Florentine Codex that, as we know, was composed in the second part of the 16th century. So, in fact, the omens referring to the fall of the Mexica were a colonial device. They were constructed after the events, having in mind similar omens from the so-called Old World. And they were also a strategy, really, that helped the Mexica cope with change.
This is really a great beginning to the ways that you connect these two cities. As a reader who's much more familiar with Mexican history than anything with the Byzantine or Eastern Roman, I gasped when I saw the mosaic of the snake and eagle doing battle on the hills of Constantinople. You continue this sort of dialogue in your next chapter, Byzantium, America, and the Modern, in which you talk about the thematic role that connected these two cities to a fundamental sense, a burgeoning sense of European modernity. So can you tell us how and in what sense these two cities came to play that role as a sort of alternative or precursor to European modernity?
Of course. This chapter really historicizes a comparative approach of Byzantium in America on the cusp of modernity, as the title of the book goes. Obviously, one could ask, what is there to compare, really, between Constantinople and Tenochtitlan to geographically and culturally distant and distinct imperial cities beyond some puzzling serendipities and beyond the fact that, obviously, historically, their conquests occurred close to each other, obviously, if we have we think of the grand scale of history, right? So in this chapter, I argue that Byzantium in America, which obviously for matters of length and balance is here metonymically represented by Tenochtitlan and the Mexica Empire more generally. So both American Byzantium are constitutive of European modernity. This means that not only did they play a crucial and important role in the self-imagining of modernity, but they also made the actualization of modernity possible. I mean, both materially and epistemically. Well, at this point, should probably point out that although the term modernity traditionally refers to the Enlightenment, scholars like Walter Mignolo, Enrique Dussel, Aníbal Quijano, among many others, actually, refer to the conquest of America in the late 15th and during the 16th century as first or early modernity, and they reserve the term second modernity for the Enlightenment, the French and Industrial Revolutions, also in reference to the second wave of European colonialism in the 19th and 20th century. So, in this chapter, I borrow the phrase, a phrase by Dussel, the phrase, the rational myth of modernity, which of course refers to modernity's narrative of superiority. what does this mean? Obviously, it refers to the fact that the moderns saw what was external in space and what was external in time as dark and regressive. I call the first process exogenous inferiorization, a term that I use to refer to modernity's defining of non-European cultures, in this case, as inferior. This view is reflected, of course, among others, in Columbus's diaries, in Hernán Cortés's letters to the emperor, to Emperor Charles V. It is also reflected in chronicles of the conquest written by conquistadors like Bernal Díaz del Castillo and his true history of the conquest of New Spain. And of course, this view was later on reflected in the writings of the philosophers of the Enlightenment, like Voltaire, Buffon, and others, who actually, with few exceptions, they saw the indigenous peoples as innocent and primitive, or savage and barbarous. Of course, we know that along with this notion of the savage, we have had that of the noble savage, the bon sauvage, which we find in the works of Rabelais, Rousseau, and others. In any case, European modernity became the standard by which contemporaneous cultures across the globe were judged and rhetorically constructed as inferior. So similarly, I use the term endogenous inferiorization to refer to the defining of Europe's own past now as inferior. We know, for instance, that the Renaissance denounced the immediate past, no? Later called the Middle Ages, as dark and retrograde. And despite the fact that later on the Western Middle Ages were gradually reinstated, thanks to the historical revisionism of the Enlightenment, but also Romanticism's idealization of medieval culture, actually the narrative of Byzantium as dark and regressive persisted in the works of philosophers like Voltaire, Montesquieu, even Gibbon, obviously, as we know, and many others. And I argue that in some way it is still reflected today in everything of contemporary pejorative uses of the adjective Byzantine in all major European languages. So I argue that America exemplifies what we could call the rational myth of modernity abroad, while Byzantium exemplifies the rational myth of modernity at home. We can think of the rhetorical construction, the rhetorical construction of the indigenous peoples as primitive and savage, and of the Middle Ages as dark and regressive, really as two tributaries of the same river. At the same time, both Byzantium and America are constitutive of modernity, as they played a crucial role in its self-imagining. And as I've already obviously said, they were instrumental in the rise and in the consolidation of the modern, both materially and epistemically.
I think this is a chapter that really shows the value of the book itself to readers from both fields of scholarship, because as a Latin Americanist, I was sort of familiar with the way that the discovery of the Americas was constitutive for European senses of modernity, but I was much less familiar with this Byzantine dimension of it. And I'm sure it's probably common in the opposite too, unless Byzantine scholars are much more globally aware than us Latin Americanists are. So I found this chapter to be very rich, and your metaphor of two tributaries leading into the same river, a particularly helpful analytic to understand this development of consciousness that's happening in this 15th and 16th century time period.
Mm-hmm. I'm glad that you found that particular chapter interesting, and obviously it helps contextualize whatever follows in the book. So yeah.
So let's move to what follows in the book. In your next chapter, chapter three, you introduce the structures and origins of the poems that the text that your book itself is about, that you're studying these moments through these poems. And it outlines the approach that you take to them, which is to study them as pieces of collective trauma, or in one case, an attempt at collective trauma. Could you tell us a little bit about the poems themselves and then how the category of collective trauma helps us understand them?
Sure. Let me first say that this chapter places the three poems within their cultural and aesthetic context. And at the same time, it sets the theoretical background of the study. So here the reader can find information on the long tradition of learned and folk laments for cities and for the dead, as well as on ritual practices. And this, obviously, this information helps contextualize the analysis of the Greek poem later on. So the anonymous author of the Greek poem, whose title is Anakalimatis Konstantinopolis, Lament for Constantinople. The anonymous poet, who was most likely a member of the upper class, by the way, drew on the tradition of Thrini. Thrini means learned, refers to, it's a term that refers to learned laments. So the poet drew on the tradition of Thrini, but also on the tradition of monodies, which were prose laments, as well as on the tradition of miroloia, a term referring to folk laments for the dead. And at the same time, the poet drew on the historical events themselves. So the poem is also written in the koine, in other words, in the standard Greek of the time, but it also incorporates some idiomatic elements, which most likely point to the island of Cyprus, which was then under Frankish rule until the year 1489. Now, similarly, the chapter discusses the pre-Columbian traditions of the Ingnoquicatl, that is, the Song of Sorrow, and Yaoquicatl, Song of War, as well as the tradition of the Cantares Mexicanos or Mexica songs. I should probably say that the Cantares Mexicanos is a corpus of 91 songs, which, although they were largely composed after 1521, after the fall of Tenochtitlan Tlatelolco, they drew closely on the pre-conquest tradition of the Cantares. And we know that the Cantares in general, I'm not referring to the Cantares Mexicanos, the corpus in particular, but the Cantares in general, we know that they were performed, they were accompanied by flutes and drums, the so-called huehuet and teponastli, which were percussion instruments, and they were also often accompanied by dance. So the songs, in Nahuatl, the word is cuicatl, the songs would have been memorized by the Mexica elite at the Calmecac, that is the public school that they attended before the conquest. And the Cantares in the Cantares Mexicanos manuscript could have been composed by those people who had attended the Calmecac prior to 1521, although I believe that they were actually composed by children of the Nahua nobility who were acquainted with the tradition of the Cantares through collecting and recording them in the second half of the 16th century. Now, as you've mentioned, Ethan, the chapter also provides information on the theoretical approach, right? And the theoretical approach draws on recent theories of collective memory and cultural trauma. Now, according to these theories, a catastrophic event, a painful event, let's say, no matter how traumatic it may be for those who actually experience it, it does not automatically qualify as cultural or collective trauma. So I'll give you some examples. Scholars like Jeffrey Alexander, for instance, argue that societies can suffer significant disruptions, that they don't ultimately consider traumatic. So cultural trauma is not the result of a pain a group may experience. In other words, the events are not inherently traumatic. Trauma is actually socially constructed. The gap and the gap between the traumatic event or events and cultural trauma is bridged through what Alexander and others call the trauma process. So the trauma process is carried out by carrier groups who have access to some kind of institutional power, and this is quite important. Among those carrier groups, we can find politicians and political leaders in general, poets, writers, artists, intellectuals more generally, who create, who forge narratives of collective pain. Now, poets, writers, and artists in particular are actually called symbol creators. At the same time, and I have in mind Niels Melzer, another theorist of cultural trauma. At the same time, once a historical memory is established as a national trauma, it must be continuously nurtured as such. It has to be continuously sustained as cultural trauma. In fact, only in this way can it continue to be considered as collective trauma, as cultural trauma affecting the community. And this particular point is extremely important, and it does help us follow the afterlife of the texts, as I argue later on in the book in the final chapter. Now, the theory also helps us trace common strategies that the creators of these three texts employ. Among them, the use of an affective language that we find in all three texts, in Lament for Constantinople, that is Anagalima, but also in Uesho Tsinkayotl and Tlaxcal Tecayotl. So all three texts draw on existing symbolic traditions as well as on the historical events themselves. They also all present those events, the events of the conquest, as an open wound on the body politic. They also all answer what theorists of cultural trauma refer to as the four critical questions. Critical in the sense, you know, critical in the process of constructing cultural trauma, critical for the trauma process. So these questions have to do with the nature of the pain, the identity of the victim, the identity of the perpetrator, and the relation between the victim and the target audience. Theories of collective memory and cultural trauma really, in this case, help us throw light on three sorrowful poems. Actually, in the case of the Cantares Mexicanos of Uesho Tsinkayotl and Tlaxcal Tecayotl, we should really be speaking of songs and not poems. But the theory here helps us throw light on the text on three texts originating from very different traditions.
I think one of the things that I found very interesting, I mean, there's many interesting points here, and the way that you theorize collective trauma is very instructive, particularly for Mexican history. It very much made me rethink the role the historical memory of the Mexica play in Mexican history. Mm-hmm. But one of the other things I enjoy about this is it is an interesting investigation of rulership and royalty, because functionally, to make this trauma collective, they need to have a suffering of a single royal figure become collective suffering. And so how do you sort of take the emperor off the top of the hierarchy and make him one of us, or make him make his suffering something relatable, even if I wasn't in Tenochtitlan or Constantinople at the time of the conquest? And that's a very interesting discursive process, which I think you very clearly lay out here and would be instructive for all sorts of scholars of trauma and memory.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with that because actually, if you think about it, I mean, my argument is that none of the composers of these three texts must have experienced the events of the conquests firsthand. If we're talking about a Cypriot poet, then probably he wouldn't have experienced those events firsthand. And if we're talking about the second generation of Nao nobility, that is, well, of children of Nao nobility that were familiar with the cantares because they collected them in the second half of the 20th century, not because they studied at the Calmecac, then obviously this points to the fact that this is not really about someone who has experienced the events. He thought that they were traumatic and then they relate them to us. But it has a lot to do with rhetorical construction of cultural trauma.
And your next chapter actually gets into the rhetoric of these poems and how they try to impart this collective trauma. Your fourth chapter, Imparting Trauma, appropriately named, begins with the Anacalema poem on the fall of Constantinople. So could you first talk a little bit about how this poem tried to impart a collective trauma in the Greek-speaking or former Eastern Roman imperial world?
Mm-hmm. Sure. But as you say, Ethan, the chapter 4 is the longest in the book because it is dedicated to a close reading of the Greek and Nahuatl texts. So really, this is where the heart of the book is beating, so to speak. Now, part 1. Of the chapter focuses on the Greek poem Anakalima. I think I should point out at this point that we should say that the poem survives in an early 16th century manuscript dating from 1509, which is held at the National Library of France. It must have been written sometime between the fall of Constantinople in 1453 and 1481. Scholars argue, and it was first published by Émile Legrand in 1875. The poem itself consists of 118 lines. The first part is a reflexive threnos or learned lament, and I say reflexive because it dramatizes. The ritual lamentation and public commemorative activities. Particularly in the embedded lament of the last Byzantine emperor, Konstantinos Palaiologos. And the second part of the poem is a more conventional threnos, a more conventional lament, learned lament. And here the narrator shares his dismay at the fall of Constantinople. So the second part consists of two sections, a dramatic narration of the events and an allegory. Which draws on lore as well as on eschatological narratives in very interesting ways, actually. Now, I've said that the anonymous poet of Anakalima, probably a member of the upper class, he articulates his trauma claim by borrowing elements from the learned and popular traditions. For example, the tradition of Thrini, but also monodies, you remember those were prose laments, also the tradition of ancient drama, supplications, folk laments, the mirologia I referred to earlier, but also funerary practices, lore, as I've just said, eschatological narratives and others. At the same time, I've said that the poet draws quite closely on the historical events, as they were recorded in texts of the time. Texts like, for instance, the histories of Mikhail Kritopoulos or Mikhail Doukas, but also in texts of Westerners who actually witnessed the events firsthand, like Ubertino Pusculo, Benvenuto Fancona, the Cardinal Isidore, and many others. So in order to articulate his trauma claim, the poet addresses the four fundamental questions, which, as I've said, are critical to the trauma process. What happened? Who suffered? Who did it? And what is the relation between victim and audience, right? the poet presents the fall of Constantinople as a wound that affects the Romae everywhere. The term that is used in the poem is pandahothen, everywhere. So it doesn't only affect those living within Byzantium, within the borders, the administrative borders of Byzantium, as it were. So among those not living within Byzantium would be obviously the Greek-speaking Orthodox Christians of places like Lusignan Cyprus, Frankish Cyprus, Venetian Crete, and Hospital Rhodes, among others. The author employs a series of rhetorical devices in his trauma claim, trauma process. Devices like repetition, anaphora, polypteton, asyndeton, and others. And he also employs visual, oral, and kinesthetic imagery. And all this together encourage, obviously, the emotional and cognitive involvement of the audience. Anakalima actually animalizes the perpetrator, Mehmet II, and he does so through the canine trope. Mehmet is called dog throughout the book. And this trope is actually frequent in learned laments in Frini on the fall of Constantinople. At the same time, Mehmet is presented as the forerunner of Antichrist. So it is interesting to see how Christian eschatology, in this case, actually collapses into history. The final line of the poem, which goes, and angels and saints no longer help, is very interesting. Why? Well, because in other learned laments of the time, in other Frini of the time, and some of them we do know that were written by monks, in other Frini of the time, we very often come across the narrative of theodicy. That is the idea that that Constantinople fell because God wanted to punish its people, because God wanted to punish its emperors for their sins. But I should probably mention here that for many Greek Orthodox and Russians, the conquest of Constantinople was a divine sanction, for what we could call the barely concealed Romans of the Palaiologan royal family with Catholicism. The Council of Ferrara Florence, which had taken place some 15 years earlier, was meant to unite the Western Catholic and Eastern Orthodox churches, which were separated since 1054. So the actual union was formally celebrated in Hagia Sophia. That was in December 1453, just a few months before the events of the fall. For this reason, actually, Hagia Sophia was seen by anti-unionists, like, for instance, the future patriarch, the first patriarch under Ottoman rule, Gennadios Hollarios, as contaminated, as a heretical place that should be avoided at all costs. Hence, the narrative of theodicy appeared, no, as I've said, in several Frini of the time, some of them written by monks. However, and this is important, in the tradition of folk poetry, of Greek folk poetry, this narrative is absent. So in Greek folk songs, common people are usually portrayed as innocent victims, victims of, say, overwhelming disasters, right? So in folk songs, the responsibility lies either with the masters or with God himself. And in that case, God is identified as the perpetrator of the tragedy. So it is interesting to see, going back to Anakalima, how a learned lament like Anakalima, a Thrinos like Anakalima, in this case, aligns itself not with learned tradition, but with folk tradition, with the tradition of folk poetry. So not only are the Romae not responsible for the tragedy, they're also abandoned by the angels and saints who no longer help, right? So in the poet's trauma claim, yes, there is divine abandonment, but there is no sense of theodicy. So just to conclude, I should also mention that in the case of Anakalima, the use of standard Greek with only some idiomatic elements in a period when Cypriot texts actually tended to favor the dialect over standard Greek may actually point, in my view, to a conscious effort on the part of the poet to actually disseminate his trauma claim as widely as possible within the Greek-speaking world of the time.
I found this, especially as a person who hasn't specialized in this field, I found this very complex view of the political and religious scene of the Eastern Mediterranean very rich and complexly and well articulated in this first part of the chapter, as you then get into how the text of the poem tries to, how the author of this poem tried to situate themselves in the most strategic and advantageous way possible. You do that again in the second half of this chapter, because like you said, this chapter is the beating heart of the book. And in the second part of this chapter, you move to the two Nahuatl language poems, On the Fall of Tenochtitlan, Tlatelolco. And these the title of these poems jumped out to me because they are named after the two of the rival cities of the Mexica, cities that actually allied with the Spanish conquistadors. So could you tell us a little bit about these poems and how they came to be named after these places? And why they failed in your assessment to impart a collective trauma in the same way as the Anakalema?
Yes. Yeah, sure. Obviously, both Tlaxcala and Huexotzinco were among the historical enemies of the Mexica. Therefore, obviously, their presence in the two songs. Is definitely deliberate. Well, let me first offer some contextual information here on the Nahuatl texts before I say a few things about their trauma claim. I've already mentioned that both songs come from the Cantares Mexicanos manuscript, which is preserved in alphabetized Nahuatl in a 16th century manuscript, which is held at the National Library of Mexico. Now, most of the songs of Cantares Mexicanos were collected between the 1550s and 1570s, perhaps with a couple of them collected a little bit later in the following decade. The songs were collected from indigenous informants. Most of them actually were, as scholars argue, from the twin cities of Ireland, the island of Mexico, that is Tenochtitlan and Tlatelolco. And some songs were collected possibly from Mexico's close ally, Azcapotzalco, on the western shore of Lake Texcoco. Now, in contrast to the Spanish narrative of the conquest, the fall of the Mexica did not result from the exceptionality of Cortés and his men. But actually from the massive rebellion of indigenous city-states, the so-called Altepetl in Nahuatl. So the massive rebellion, indigenous rebellion against a much hated empire, let's say, the Mexica Empire. So we know, for instance, that in the final stage of the conquest, the Spaniards were less than 1%, actually, of the army of Cortés. I think Ross Hasek reports that there were about 900 Spaniards as opposed to 200,000 indigenous warriors fighting against the Mexica. Now, among those trying to topple the Mexica were obviously the Tlaxcalteca and Huexotzinca that appear in none of the songs in Tlaxcaltecayotl. Like the author of Anakalima, I've said that the composers of Huexotzincayotl and Tlaxcaltecayotl, they borrow elements from the pre-Columbian tradition, especially the tradition of pre-Hispanic cantares, But they also draw on sacrificial rituals at the Templo Mayor in Tenochtitlan. And at the same time, of course, they commemorate the events of the siege and fall of Tenochtitlan, Tlatelolco in 1521. And again, as in the case of historical information about the fall of Constantinople, in this case, again, the events were recorded in contemporary sources like the Florentine Codex or the Annales, the Tlatelolco, the Annals of Tlatelolco, both indigenous sources, right? So so here too, history and tradition become really the vehicles through which the composers of the songs aim to first articulate and then transmit and disseminate the trauma of the conquest to the wider community. Now, Huexotzincayotl is a relatively brief song. It only consists of 10 stanzas. Here we actually find no direct reference to the Huexotzinca, apart from the title of the subgenre to which the song belongs. We know, for example, from the physician Francisco Hernández, who visited Mexico in the 1570s, that this subgenre of Huexotzincayotl, not the actual song we have in we're talking about, but this subgenre refer to war songs in which the Mexicas celebrated their victory over the Huexotzinca. Such songs, Hernández tells us, were sung when Huexotzinca captives were taken by the Mexica to be sacrificed at the Templo Mayor in Tenochtitlan. Now, going back to her song, Huexotzincayotl, here, the place of the victims, which was previously occupied by the Huexotzinca, is now taken by the Mexica themselves. So you see that there is an interesting slippage, let's say, from victor to victim in this case. The victor becomes victim. However, in the song proper, that is in the 10 stanzas of the song, there is no reference to the Huexotzinca or the Spaniards or any other indigenous ally for that matter. In fact, we learn that the affliction that has befallen Mexicayotl is the doing of Ipalnemoani. That's what we have in the text. And the term Ipalnemoani is a generic deity epithet, literally meaning he by whom one lives, or life giver, let's say. So this generic term is used in the song so that native notions of divinity could appear to be compatible with Christianity. Ipalnemoani in Huexotzincayotl is actually a veiled reference to God Huitzilopochtli or Tezcatlipoca, embodying the supreme deity in the eyes of the Mexica. So in the song, the Mexica accept limited responsibility for the events. They admit that they may have been lax or negligent, and therefore they may have breached sacred rituals. Now, according to the Nahua belief system, such negligence could actually bring about temporary periods of chaos, of disorder, right? So, but it's important to keep that although they acknowledge that they may have been negligent, this is a rather vague and limited acceptance of responsibility. The Mexica do not admit sin or guilt, say, in the Christian moral sense of the term. I think it's Louise Burkhardt who writes in her book, The Slippery Earth, that their age, the age of the fifth son, was a time of relative chaos anyway. So the Mexica knew that disorderly periods were, in a sense, were inevitable. But there is no sense of Christian sin in the song. I repeat this because it's quite important. So the Spanish narrative of the conquest as a victory of the Christian God over the pagans is surely absent in this case. Instead, the culture of trauma is a result of divine sanctions, which in turn seem to be the result of the Meshika breaching sacred rituals. So ultimately, divinity occupies here the space of the perpetrator. Now, contrary to Wesho Tsingayodl, the second song, Tlaxcaltecayodl, attributes responsibility to the indigenous allies of the Spaniards, particularly to their traditional enemies, no, the Tlaxcalteca, hence Tlaxcaltecayodl. So in this song, which is about three times longer than the other one, Wesho Tsingayodl, the Mexica imagine the Tlaxcalteca relishing their humiliation. That is, the Mexica imagine them relishing the humiliation of the Mexica, which is an interesting concept. So, whereas in Wesho Tsingayodl, the perpetrator is, as I've said, Ipalnemoane, interestingly, in Tlaxcaltecayodl, responsibility lies with Cortés's now allies, and not actually with the Spaniards, the Spaniards are mentioned in the song, but the emphasis is not on them. And they almost, I think, they never appear in the refrains, for instance, only the Wesho Tsinga and Tlaxcalteca do, as far as I can remember now. So I argue that this has less to do with Spanish censorship or the position of the composer in early colonial Mexico, and it has to do more with the now worldview and also the indigenous view of the conquest as an act of defiance against the Mexica Empire. In fact, the now elite did not generally embrace, let's say, a conquest narrative. This is another important point to bear in mind. Colonial Nahuas developed what Jorge Clor de Alba has called a counter-narrative of continuity. This counter-narrative of continuity helped them find their niche in the new colonial order, and it also stood at the opposite end, at the opposite side of the Spanish narrative of the conquest as rupture. That is, as a break, as a cultural and epistemic break between pagan past and Christian present. So colonial Nahuas, including the Mexica elite, that is, asserted a historical continuum before and after the fall of Tenochtitlan. And they could do so thanks to the Nahua worldview, and more specifically, thanks to the rotational ordering scheme, which essentially meant that that one thing is replaced, is substituted by another. Burkhard actually argues that this rotational ordering scheme allowed the Nahua to conceptualize the conquest not as a watershed event, not as a break or rupture with the past, but actually as a rotating shift. So what did this mean? It meant that the events of the conquest, the shift, the transition to the Spanish rule, and the epidemic diseases that plagued colonial Mexico in the 16th century, the Coco Lisli, were seen as part of this rotational order, which in the past had brought about diseases, natural disasters, wars, etc., etc. No, so just to conclude, it is not surprising that laments like Anacalima are not so frequent. They're actually rare in the surviving corpus from early colonial Mexico. Thanks to the counter-narrative of continuity in early colonial Mexico, there was a tendency to elide rather than to lament over the transition to Spanish rule. Also, let's not forget that many Nahuas, including the Tlaxcalteca and the Wesho Tsinga, had played an an active role and an important role in the conquest by siding with Cortés. Therefore, songs like Huexotzincayotl and Tlaxcaltecayotl are unique, really. They are exceptions to the rule. As I argue in the book, the songs are seeds sown on barren ground, so to speak. They were composed by members of the now elite who went against dominant attitudes of the time and who lamented the fall of the imperial city as a major disruption.
So I think it's very interesting that you show how collective trauma does and doesn't last and be constructed in these two different societies in response to their conquest. And your book really wraps up nicely as you talk about the afterlives of these different texts in a chapter appropriately titled Texts in Their Afterlife. Could you tell us a little bit more about this fifth and final chapter where you discuss and explore how these historical moments of conquest have played out in national life since the 15th and 16th centuries in Mexico and Greece, respectively?
Sure. Let me first say that all three texts address the four critical questions of the trauma claim, of the trauma claim process, regarding the nature of the pain, the identity of the victim, the identity of the perpetrator, and the relation between victim and audience. Also, all three texts are imbued with pessimism. Constantinople, we are told in the poem, is now a Turkopoli, a city of Turks, and Tenochtitlan has been abandoned, which is an idea repeated both in Huexotzincayotl and Tlaxcaltecayotl. In all these cases, the cultural trauma is constructed by drawing both on available, on recognizable traditions or symbolic resources, but also obviously on the historical events recorded in contemporary sources, as I have said. So the three texts imaginatively reenact the disruptive events of the conquests with a view to imparting their trauma claims to the broader community. In both cases. Now, in principle, all three accounts could serve as, say, as vehicles for the transgenerational transmission of trauma. Although in reality, different historical environments, different historical contexts led to different historical roots. In the case of Greece, in post-independence Greece, by the way, this year Greece celebrates its bicentennial of the Greek War of Independence. So in post-independence Greece, learned laments like Anagkalima and folk songs about the fall of Constantinople found their place in school textbooks. And of course, as we know, schools are among the most important institutional arenas. This is a term I borrow from Geoffrey Alexander. So schools have an institutional power when it comes to disseminating, but also when it comes to sustaining cultural trauma. So Greek folk songs, including songs about the fall of Constantinople, were transmitted orally until the 19th century, at least. In rural areas, and it was in the 19th century when they were collected and recorded. Their collection actually coincided with the processes of nation building in Greece, as well as with Greek irredentism, and was actually often guided by them. By Greek irredentism, I refer to the so-called Megali Idea, or great idea or grand vision, however you want to translate it. The Megali Idea became the ideological core of the Hellenic state more or less for a century. According to the Megali Idea, there was in post-independence Greece, there was still a need to liberate all those Greek-speaking subjects who lived in areas outside the borders of the nascent Greek state, mostly in the areas once belonging to the Byzantine Empire. So folk laments, as well as thrini, that is, learned laments, like Anakalima, were really signs of an open wound and cultural trauma that had shaped, that have formed the identity of the Greeks ever since the fall of Constantinople. The Megali there came to an end in 1922 following the Greco-Turkish War, as it is known in Greek, the Asia Minor disaster, Mikrasiatiki Katastrophe. I've noted a few times today how once cultural trauma is constructed, it needs to be continuously nurtured and sustained through various institutional channels. The trauma of the fall of Constantinople has become, I would say, a kind of an archetypal trauma, a kind of an Ur trauma, so to speak, one that stands for all the traumas of the Greeks, including the Turkish invasion of Cyprus in 1974. Now, the case of Mexico and that of Cantares Mexicanos are different. Apparently, the manuscript was forgotten until the second half of the 19th century, when it was rediscovered in the National Library of Mexico. How did this happen? Well, the difficult language of Cantares Mexicanos as a whole must have been one reason why the tradition of the Cantares withered away towards the end of the 16th century, by which time, of course, the authors of the songs must have died. Colonial censorship may have been another reason. But in the case of our two songs, Huexotzincayotl and Tlaxcaltecayotl, I also see another reason, which has to do with their trauma claim. Scholars like Nils Melzer argue that one of the strategies against trauma is to turn negative events into positive events. Similarly, Ron Eierman speaks of traumatic events which can actually be projected as the beginnings of a collectivity. So traumatic events can become part of founding narratives. They can be given, let's say, a positive spin. Now, did this happen with early colonial Nahuas? Well, no. We've seen that this was not the case, partly because of the counter-narrative of continuity, And the now a notion of the rotational ordering scheme that did not favor the idea of watershed events, as we've seen, and partly because of the view that the conquest was a massive indigenous rebellion against the Mexica. We have to remember that Huexotzincayotl and Tlaxcaltecayotl were exceptions, not the rule. But here's another question now. Could the conquest be read, be viewed as cultural trauma retrospectively? Say, could that happen in post-independence Mexico? Well, in theory, yes. Did this happen? No. Why? Well, because of the narrative of mestizaje, whose birth scholars trace in the Porfiriato, and more specifically in the works of such intellectuals as Justo Sierra, who was also Secretary of Public Education between 1905 and up to the end of the Porfiriato in 1911. In the post-revolution era, the narrative of mestizaje is cemented in the writings of influential figures like José Vasconcelos, who was also, by the way, Secretary of Public Education in the early 1920s. So, according to the narrative of mestizaje, modern Mexico was quite literally thought to have emerged from the conquest. And mestizaje was symbolically represented, no, by the union of Cortés and Malintzin, no, the woman from Veracruz who was Cortés's translator, strategist, and companion. At the same time, mestizaje was embodied quite literally by Malintzin's and Cortés's son, Martín Cortés, El Mestizo. So contrary to the modern Greek reading of the Ottoman conquest as a watershed event and deep-rooted cultural trauma as a wound on the body politic, and in contrast to the counter-narrative of continuity of the early colonial Nahua elite, 20th century Mexican nationalism put a positive spin on the conquest of Tenochtitlan, Tlatelolco. The fall of the empire, the fall of the Mexica Empire, was retrospectively projected now by the urban elites as the birth of the mestizo nation. So understandably, the conquest could not be read in negative terms. It could not be interpreted in negative terms as a negative affect, as a pain, not as an open wound and a deep-seated cultural trauma. In other words, the conquest was seen as constitutive, not disruptive of being Mexican. So, on the other hand, in theory, carrier groups among the indigenous peoples in post-revolutionary Mexico could have retrospectively as well projected the fall of Tenochtitlan, Tlatelolco as cultural trauma. However, sadly, we know that such groups would need access to institutional power. They would need access to resources. They would need access to, say, authority with which to disseminate their trauma claim. We know that indigenous peoples have been largely excluded from those areas. In fact, millions of indigenous Mexicans from various ethnic groups live on the margins of society and find themselves at the bottom of socioeconomic indicators. So today, Huexotzincayotl and Tlaxcaltecayotl mostly entertain a close circle of scholars, no? And we may find them on some university courses. But contrary to Anacalima, the two songs are not standard inclusions in school manuals, for instance. For a long time, the songs appeared in a veiled form in Miguel León Portilla's seminal book, The Broken Spears. The title in Spanish is Visión de los Vencidos, which was originally published in 1959, I think, and was later included in a suggested reading in the curriculum of Mexican and Latin American literature of the National Preparatory High School. Now, in The Broken Spears, there is no mention of the original titles of the two songs. Folio numbers are absent, and different parts of the songs are clumped together in a rather arbitrary way, and therefore uprooting the songs from their Cantares Mexicanos context. León Portillo, of course, along with his mentor Garibay, Ángel María Garibay, made a monumental contribution to Nahuatl literary studies, and of course it is thanks to them that Nahuatl studies came to prominence in the second half of the 20th century. But the domesticating strategy we see in works like the Broken Spears reflects the general erosion, I would say, of indigenous difference vis-a-vis the dominant rhetoric of mestizaje. None of the two songs appear in recent textbooks that I have been able to consult, despite the fact that since 2011, the entire corpus, actually, of Cantares Mexicanos has been available in Spanish in a translation by Leon Portilla himself. Meanwhile, of course, Anna Gallima continues to enjoy a privileged position in contemporary textbooks in both Greece and Cyprus today.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is a very interesting comparison. And like you said, this is the 200th anniversary of Greek independence, and this fall will hit the 500th anniversary of the fall of Tenochtitlan Tlatelolco. Mm-hmm. So it'll be interesting to see how these memories and histories continue to evolve.
Precisely.
As in more anniversaries in the future. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for your time today and excellent answers about an excellent book, Eleni. Before we go, could you tell us what is next for you? What are you working on now or plan to work on in the future?
Right. Okay. Yeah. At this point, I'm actually working on two different projects, the first one is an interdisciplinary study of urban space in Argentina in the 1920s and 1930s from the vantage point of the visual arts and literature, and more specifically painting, photography, silent film, poetry, and the novel. The book is called 5-in-1 Thesis on Modernity, Buenos Aires Across the Arts, 1921-1939, and will appear in the series Illuminations, Cultural Formations of the Americas of the University of Pittsburgh Press in 2022. I should probably mention that this project was funded by the Arts and Humanities Research Council in the UK. Interestingly, I know that this will sound strange, but this this project is very much related to the Concord, because it was when I was writing the introduction to this decade-long project that I started researching on modernity's conceptual others, the non-moderns, the pre-moderns, etc. And I ended up researching on Byzantium and pre-Columbian America. And that research, which was, as I've said, kind of a theoretical study of the term modern and the notion of modernity, that introduction ended up being a separate a book project, which is the second project I'm currently working on. So this second project, which I'm hoping to complete sometime sooner than later, in some way complements the Concord in the sense that it partly explores ideas expressed in seminal form, of course, in the chapter Byzantium, America, and the Modern. So I'm working on a theoretical study of the notions of modern and modernity, as I've said. I'm particularly interested in modernity's fixation with the idea of infinite progress. And the book, among other things, as I've suggested, implied, recontextualizes Byzantium and pre-contact America within the crisis of the present, especially the anthropogenic climate change that we now know has sadly become the most important existential threat that humanity is facing. So one of my arguments in this book is that in our fast-moving and ecologically challenged modernity, Byzantium and pre-contact America and the rhetorical constructions by the moderns matter more than ever. But I should probably stop here and not be a spoiler. thank you so much, Ethan, for reading the book and obviously for giving me the opportunity to talk about it. It's been a real pleasure to have this interview with you today.
And it's been a pleasure for me and hopefully our listeners as well. I can't recommend this book enough. And thank you for your time, Eleni.
Thank you. Thank you, Ethan.